You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller, featuring Smitten Kitchen. Today we're going to start off with a simple but yummy recipe, blistered peas in the pod with lemon and salt. Even though my kids are not yet on summer break, and even though I, as an adult, do not have a thing called a summer break, I've apparently helped myself to one. I'm sneaking off to the beach on weekdays, reading novels, playing midday tennis like a lady who lunches, and getting vexed when I receive work-related emails and texts. Alex, why are they texting me on a Sunday? Deb, it's Tuesday. I went to the small green market in my neighborhood yesterday with no plan except to buy more cucumbers and cherries and hoped I'd find something inspiring. Forgetting that in June, everything is. I was filling my bag with three types of zucchini, peaches, onions, sugar snaps, green and yellow beans, beefsteak tomatoes, and fresh peas when I spotted the chef owner of a favorite neighborhood restaurant across the table. I asked what he was planning to do with the Romano beans he was bagging. Pressure cook, it turns out. So cool. And I was about to ask him if he'd ever grilled peas in their pods, whole, and eaten them like edamame, and abruptly realized that I don't think I've ever told you that we should be grilling peas in their pods, whole, and eating them like edamame. So I rushed home to do just that, delighted to have succeeded in finding something to keep my focus on work for the rest of the afternoon. That's it, by the way. That's the recipe. I first spotted the method in Susan Spungen's Open Kitchen Cookbook years ago, and it remains a favorite because it's wildly simple. The peas cook perfectly inside the pod without ever getting mushy. I don't use a vegetable grilling basket since they're large enough to easily stretch across grates, and the salty, charred, edged, sweet-centered results turn people who think they don't like peas into people who lick a plate of them clean. It's a fun thing to bring to a barbecue, as I will this afternoon, so that everyone can eat them hot off the grill. You can serve them two ways. Number one, whole, just sprinkled with a little salt, pepper flakes, and lemon zest. Or two, you can peel back half the pod, exposing the sweet little peas inside, and sprinkle them with all of the above, and also some fresh mint and crumbled salty cheese, since they're now on a little raft that can help transit these delicious extras directly into your mouth. Here's the official recipe, blistered peas in the pod with lemon and salt. Serves four as a side or eight as an appetizer. Time, 15 minutes. Source, recipe from Smitten Kitchen, method inspired by Susan Spungen. You'll need 1 pound of fresh English or sweet peas still in their pods, olive oil, salt, freshly ground black pepper or red pepper flakes, finely grated zest and a few wedges of one lemon, a handful of mint leaves, chopped, these are optional, and a half cup of crumbled ricotta salad or feta, also optional. Wash and pat dry the fresh peas in their pods and toss in a bowl with a drizzle of olive oil. Heat your grill to a medium-high temperature and use tongs to arrange the pea pods across the grill grate so that they don't fall in. Grill for about 5 minutes on the first side until blistered and dark in spots underneath, and then flip the pea pods over and repeat on the second side for another 5 minutes, adding another minute or two if needed. Note, my grill is small and fairly weak, so this might take less time on a more robust grill. Look for blistering, not a measured amount of time. Then you're going to transfer your grilled peas to a serving plate and season with salt, pepper, and lemon zest. Nestle the lemon wedges on the plate for those who want fresh juice on theirs. And there are two ways to serve these. One is edamame style, served in the closed pods, just like this, to be eaten edamame style, i.e. holding the pod in your hand and popping the peas into your mouth and discarding the pod. Or two, raft style. Alternatively, you can peel open the pods, exposing the row of peas inside. And with this method, I season the insides as well with salt, pepper, and zest. Add the optional extras of mint and crumbled cheese, and then you can serve these hot or warm. There will be no leftovers. Our next recipe is for Nancy's chopped salad. Some people just need help putting together a salad. I'm one of those people. And here we go. When it comes to meal salads, I feel pretty much everything you need to know is summed up in one of my favorite commercials of all times, which assures you that no matter what's in your bowl, deep fried taco shell, ground beef, guacamole, sour cream and cheese, as long as it vaguely resembles a salad, it must be good for you. Is it healthy? Of course it is. It's a salad, isn't it? I bring it up today because we have fallen madly in love with a salad that I am not sure we're eating for any of the earnest reasons that one usually eats a salad, like a desire for leafy greens, fresh vegetables, or to be enviable in a swimsuit. Nope, I'm pretty sure that this is the best salad ever because it tastes exactly like an Italian sub, minus that all too frequently lackluster bread, which totally makes it healthy. Fortunately, it has other good qualities. It's cold and refreshing, a plus at dinner time as it gets hotter outside, and my indoor cooking energies wane. If you're a closet iceberg lover in a baby field greens world, as I am, here you are free to be true to your salad crunching self. If you grew up good eating good seasons Italian dressing from the seasonings packet, you're going to have something of a Proustian moment, but so much better, over the dressing here, which is thick with a pulp of freshly chopped garlic and dried oregano before lemon juice, red wine vinegar, and olive oil are whisked in. If you have anyone in your family like my husband who eats peppercini straight from a jar he could single-handedly decimate in 2 days, this salad will make their year. You can use up those extra chickpeas you soaked last week. You can begin working away at the mounting cherry tomato supply. If you're in one of the climates where they're emerging, you can serve this deconstructed if you have the kind of small people in your household who will eat many of these ingredients, but only if they're unmixed. So you can also make a killer good salad for dinner tonight from fairly basic ingredients, because I live on the wrong coast. I haven't been to Pizzeria Moza, one of Nancy Silverton's beloved Los Angeles restaurants, but through the power of the internet, longing, and cookbooks, I managed to make it a whole 2 days between learning about this salad and making it at home, after which I immediately kicked myself for waiting even that long, so don't let this happen to you. Here's the recipe, Nancy's Chopped Salad. Adapted mostly from the Moza cookbook by Nancy Silverton, Matt Molina, and Carolyn Carino, brought to my attention by Gluten-Free Girl. Thank you. I realize that chopping half a pound of salami and cheese into a salad is probably not on most of our swimsuit season agendas, but it's worth considering that the proportions below will make 6 meal-sized salads. I couldn't eat a bite more than one portion either night that we had this. And if you're still nervous, I think you could easily use half the salami and cheese and not miss a whole lot. Provolone comes softer, less aged, more typical on sandwiches, and more firm, aged with a sharper, saltier flavor. I used an aged provolone. If doing so, I recommend starting with half the recommended cheese so it doesn't overwhelm. If you're lucky enough to have to be somewhere that you can readily purchase Sicilian oregano, it's absolutely amazing here. Finally, Silverton calls for a small head of iceberg, but when I used one, I found there to be more dressing than needed. I'd instead recommend a larger head of iceberg or holding back some vinaigrette to add only if needed. And by the way, almost every instance of this recipe I've seen online and in print uses different quantities and size suggestions, 1/2 inch wide ribbons versus 1/4 inch thin versus slices versus thick, small versus large heads of lettuce, more or less chickpeas, which means you especially should feel free to adjust everything below just to taste. Save a few adjustments, see above, I made it as printed below. This makes 6 meal-sized salads or 12 side portions. For the oregano dressing, you'll need 4 cloves of garlic, 1 to 2 tablespoons of dried oregano. Nancy recommends 2. I got nervous and used 1, but might not have minded more. 2 teaspoons of kosher salt, freshly ground black pepper, 2 tablespoons of lemon juice or the juice of 1 lemon, 1/4 cup of red wine vinegar, 1/4 cup of olive oil, ideally extra virgin. For the salad and assembly, you'll need 1 15-ounce can of chickpeas or 1 3/4 cups of cooked chickpeas, drained, 1 small red onion, peeled and sliced into paper-thin rings, 1/2 pound of provolone, sliced 1/8 inch thick and then cut into 1/4 inch ribbons. You'll need 1/2 pound of salami, peeled and sliced 1/8 inch thick and then into 1/4 inch ribbons. 4 medium or 8 small pickled peppercini, sliced into rings. 3/4 pounds of cherry tomatoes, sea salt. 1 head of iceberg lettuce, halved, cored, and cut into 1/2 inch ribbons. 1 head of radicchio, halved, cored, and cut into 1/4 inch ribbons. And then 2 tablespoons of dried oregano for garnish. This is optional. To make the dressing, you're going to roughly chop the garlic and then add the oregano, salt, and up to 1/2 teaspoon of ground pepper. Chop the mixture together and use the side of a knife or a mortar and pestle to make a grainy herb paste. Transfer the paste to a large salad bowl and add the lemon juice and vinegar and mix with a fork, allowing the salt to dissolve. Then add the oil and whisk with a fork until well combined. The dressing should be thick with garlic and oregano. If you're using a small head of iceberg, transfer 1/3 of the dressing into a small bowl to be used only if needed. And for a larger head of iceberg, you'll want it all. And then assemble the salad. You're going to gently fold the chickpeas, red onion, provolone, salami, peppercini, including the seeds and juice, into the dressing, 1 at a time. Have the tomatoes lengthwise and season with 1 1/2 teaspoons of sea salt and set aside until ready to serve. To serve, gently add the tomatoes, lettuce, and radicchio to the salad bowl along with a couple of generous pinches of oregano and toss to combine with the dressing. Adjust seasonings to taste and adding any reserved dressing if needed and serve immediately. For our next recipe, we're going to have soft eggs with buttery herb Gruyere toasts. I wish I could tell you that I had good reasons for sharing this recipe today, earnest ones. If I weren't a different sort of writer, I might dig deep into my past and crank out a few graphs about my late German grandfather, who ate a soft-boiled egg for breakfast every morning for as long as my mother remembers. Also brisket for dinner. Maybe I'd tell you about the period of 2004 when I did the same thing, pining for the perfect crouton, perhaps buttered toast fingers raised to a previously unfathomable level of deliciousness, but didn't get to it until this week. And while each story would be in some ways true, none are the actual truth, which is that we're talking about soft-boiled eggs today because, OMG, I found the cutest set of egg cups with chickens, and I had to buy them. Yeah, shopping. I told you the story would be better left to a more artful scribe, but to buy them, however, I'd have to use them, and to use them, it was time to consider the crouton, and not just any crouton, but the very most intensely delicious crouton that I could dream up. There's an ample amount of melted butter and a slip of Dijon mustard. There's Gruyere and a tiny bit of Romano cheese, whose kicky, nutty saltiness has me fixated lately. There are herbs, too, and this whole mixture is literally caked onto fingers of sourdough bread and then roasted in the oven until bronzed, fragrant, and tormenting. Nevertheless, I hope you can forgive this extended obsessive breakfast kick that I'm on. It's what I do when the weather is warm and I crave lighter meals, but spring produce is yet to be seen. Plus, as we all know, eggs are hardly just breakfast food, and these croutons needn't be limited to breakfast. Cut into cubes, they could turn into the saddest bag of freakishly ever fresh salad greens into something you'd eagerly anticipate. Although for this, I'd probably swap smooth Dijon for coarse, and add a pressed garlic clove as well. And when those little green spears do emerge from the earth, I'd make this ribbon salad with a couple of those on the side. They also make excellent rewards for kitchen help should you keep your own heap underfoot. Soft eggs with buttery herb Gruyere toast soldiers. I include the basic, simple soft-boiled egg instructions that always work for me. However, if you want a very cool read on how to obsessively ensure that your eggs are perfect every single time, then I've got a link here at smittenkitchen.com. You're going to need 16 sourdough toast fingers. Mine were from 1/2-inch thick slices cut into 1/2-inch batons. 4 tablespoons, that's 2 ounces, of unsalted butter melted. 1 teaspoon of smooth Dijon mustard. Salt. Freshly ground black pepper. 1/3 cup of finely grated Gruyere cheese, that's about 1.5 ounces. 2 tablespoons of finely grated Romano cheese, 1 tablespoon of finely chopped flat leaf parsley, and 1 teaspoon of finely chopped fresh thyme leaves. This is optional. And 4 large eggs. To make the croutons, you're going to preheat your oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Place the bread cubes in shallow, wide bowl and whisk together the butter and Dijon, and then pour over the bread fingers. Sprinkle with salt, pepper, both types of cheese, parsley, and thyme if using, and toss to coat. Spray the rimmed baking sheet with nonstick spray and scatter the bread on the sheet. Bake the croutons until crisp and golden, turning about 20 minutes, and set aside. Meanwhile, cook your eggs. Bring a medium pot of water to a steady boil. Add eggs and cook them for exactly 6 minutes, maintaining the heat at a simmer, and then drain and rinse them briefly in cold water. Holding the egg vertically, pointer side down, with a towel or paper towel to protect you from its heat, tap a knife around the neck about 1/2 inch below the top so that you can remove the little lid area. Place the egg in a small dish, open side up, and serve with a small spoon and toast soldiers. If you don't have adorable chicken or any other kind of tiny egg cups and spoons, with a little patience, you can peel the soft-boiled eggs as you would a hard-boiled one. It's tricky because they are liquid in the center, but it's doable. For this method, arrange 4 of your croutons on a small plate, and then place the peeled egg over the croutons and smash it lightly, delightfully. If you don't find this to be really fun, I'm not sure we can be friends. With a fork. Season with salt and pepper and eat with a fork and knife. For our next recipe, we're going to have salted caramel brownies. Yum. A couple of months ago, someone requested that I try my hand at caramel brownies. Amazingly, this person was not my husband, but he endorsed this idea so wholeheartedly that I suspect he might have paid this person off. Then again, in most people's minds, who doesn't want to make caramel brownies? I mean, what kind of strange person considers what would happen when sea salt-flecked, deeply copper-colored homemade caramel meets a chewy, rich homemade brownie and then shrugs it off? Eh, I'll pass. Guys, it's me. It's not that I didn't think that a salted caramel brownie could be delicious. It's just that I imagine it's well-trodden territory, which to me translates to as people who want to make this already know how to. And then I figure my time would be better spent making other things, like weird egg salads and silky hummus. But then I did a quick search or two. I discovered things that caused me to make that crooked face that I make when I'm thinking really hard. Because sometimes after a day of explaining to a preschooler why we have to wear pants when we leave the apartment, when I fully understand the desire to simply not wear pants, sometimes thinking is really hard. The first is that a whole lot of recipes started with store-bought caramels or caramel sauce, which made me sad because the homemade stuff requires 3 ingredients that you probably have, it's really easy to make, and the flavor comparison, especially if you add a 4th ingredient, salt, well, there is none. They barely deserve to share the same name. And the next thing that gave me pause was that they all looked achingly sweet, as if little consideration was given to the fact that dousing an already sweet brownie with caramel sauce might cause teeth to hurt and dentists to buy new vacation homes. By now, I already accepted that any further resistance would be futile. I mean, if you were to distill any given Smitten Kitchen blog entry into the simplest formula, most of the time it would be roughly 2 equals 2 causes of furrowed brow, piqued curiosity, plus 1 polite request, plus 1 borderline begging request, plus a notable absence of willpower. But as I got into the kitchen, I found a third source of drama, which was in how the caramel brownie merger should be approached. Spreading half the batter in the pan, covering it with caramel, and then adding the second half of the brownie batter was kind of difficult, and the caramel filling all but disappeared into the brownie. A marbled attempt not only led to vanished caramel, but it left trenches in the brownie tops where the caramel once had been, like some sort of sad memorial. And that thing I realized was, if I'm going to eat something called a caramel brownie, what I'm really hoping for are parts instantly recognizable as either. I want the caramel to tangle around the brownie and vice versa, not just dissolved into a caramel-flavored brownie. So the only idea I had left was the craziest one, wherein you kind of fake make caramel candies that are cold and big enough that they take longer to disappear into the batter than the batter takes to bake. The results, however, are madness, and I urge you not to make them. Why? Why take these this far only to send you home? Because no good can come of them. They're ludicrously rich, but not icky sweet, so it's easy to forget that you should never, ever eat more than one. They're so loud with dark chocolate and salted caramel flavors, they might even be better than either part. Worse, they're structurally unsound. Those squares of caramel melt into puddles that trickle out when you slice them, leaving a weak, almost gooey chocolate foundation behind. I mean, trickling salted caramel? Gooey chocolate? Yuck! All right, it's okay, guys. I'm happy to audition these terrible things that you do not have to. What a relief, right? Here's the recipe. Salted caramel brownies. I used my standard approach to salted caramel, but I dialed back the heavy cream so that it would be less soft and therefore better able to hold up in the batter. The brownie is my one bowl favorite with less sugar and less salt to compensate for that sweetness and extra salt in the caramel. The result is a soft, messy brownie that is much, much easier to cut neatly if placed in the freezer until semi-firm. It makes one 8x8 pan of brownies, which you can cut into 16 2-inch squares or 25 smaller squares, 32 2x1-inch bites, or a mess of hearts from a cookie cutter. So for the caramel, you need 1/2 cup of granulated sugar, 4 tablespoons of unsalted butter, or salted, but then you have to ease up on the sea salt. Heaped 1/4 teaspoon of flaky sea salt, or 1/8 teaspoon table salt, more to taste, and 3 tablespoons of heavy cream. For the brownie, 3 ounces of unsweetened chocolate, roughly chopped, 1 stick of unsalted butter, plus extra for the pan, 1 cup of granulated sugar, 2 large eggs, 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, and a heaped 1/4 teaspoon of flaky sea salt, or 1/8 teaspoon of table salt, 2/3 cup of all-purpose flour. To make the caramel, you're going to set a square of parchment paper over a medium-sized plate, lightly butter or coat the parchment with a spray oil, and just as an added security measure, and then in a medium-dry saucepan over medium-high heat, you're going to melt your sugar. This will take about 5 minutes, stirring if necessary to break up large chunks. By the time it's all melted, it should be a nice copper color, and if not, cook it until it is. Remove from the heat and stir in the butter. It may not incorporate entirely, but do your best. Stir in the cream and salt and return to the saucepan to the stove over medium-high heat, bringing it back to a simmer and melt it again any sugar that solidified. Cook the bubbling caramel for a few minutes more until it is a shade darker. Then you're going to pour out onto parchment-covered plate and transfer your plate to the freezer. Freeze until solidified, which can take anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes in a decent freezer to 40 minutes in my terrible one. So meanwhile, or when your caramel is almost firm, you're going to make your brownies. Heat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Line an 8x8-inch square baking pan with parchment, extending it up 2 sides. Butter the parchment or spray it with a nonstick cooking spray and in a medium heat-proof bowl over gently simmering water, you're going to melt the chocolate and butter together until only a couple of unmelted bits remain. Off the heat, stir until smooth and fully melted. You can also do this in the microwave in 30-second bursts, stirring between each. Whisk in the sugar, then the eggs one at a time, and then vanilla and salt. Stir in flour with a spoon or a flexible spatula, and then assemble the brownies. So when the caramel is firm, remove it from the freezer and chop it into rough 1-inch squares. Gently fold all but a small amount of the caramel bits into the batter and scrape the batter into the prepared pan, spreading it until mostly even. Scatter the remaining caramel bits on top and bake in a heated oven for 30 minutes until a toothpick inserted into the center comes out clean. Cool thoroughly, a process that can be hastened in the freezer, which will also produce cleaner cuts and cut into squares or other desired shapes. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller.